you know, people can have very entrepreneurial ambitions, but like starting on first base really helps, which is we both were extremely opinionated about what good looks like in the data space. Mm.
And you had credibility, right? Like having worked in many of these.
We had a little bit of that.
Hey everybody, John Deschotsky here on another episode of Seed Stories. Actually, first live one.
All right.
I mean, this is exciting. We've got Fish, also known as Peter, who started Mozart Data and is wearing the swag. Very excited. Glad to have you here today.
Great to be here.
Awesome. So give me the elevator pitch on Mozart Data. Let's go right into it.
Sure. We're the easiest way to spin up a modern data stack. What that ultimately means is we do the work that you would typically hire a data engineer to do: extract, load, and transform your data, manage data warehouse, and then again, sort of this big sort of effort cleaning your core tables so that they're ready for a BI tool.
Sounds super valuable. We were chatting earlier, and like you're part of the Yammerites, or what do we call them?
I call them the Yammerati.
The Yammerati.
Yeah.
Okay. So along with Saxy Poo and that whole crew,
sure.
Give us your background. I mean, like you've been at some pretty killer companies, but take us back a little bit further. How'd you get into technology?
Sure. So I actually studied like economics and psychology and statistics. So I did a PhD in behavioral economics at Cal and fell in love with the Bay Area and really wanted to stay here. And the way that you stay in the Bay Area is that you work in tech. So I found my way into the startup world, started working at a company called Playdom.
Mm-hmm.
Playdom was,
the gaming company.
It was a gaming company that ultimately got bought by Disney, sort of at the peak of the social gaming craze. Now, Zynga actually recently got sold just a couple days ago, but Playdom and Zynga used to go really head-to-head on a lot of those titles and a lot of that sort of the social gaming on Facebook. And there was just a ton of data in that world. It was really amazing. Like, we had, like, you know, 500 million users. I mean, they were Facebook users, but we had just lots and lots and lots of users generating lots and lots and lots of data, and they just started hiring people that knew how to crunch what was big amounts of data in those days.
Hmm.
So I was one of them, and I got hired to be a data analyst, and I worked with all the different game studios. And then actually a couple floors down from our San Francisco office was this company, Yammer. I say that I, you know, got off on the wrong floor one day post-acquisition, and then ended up at Yammer, and that was really the defining job in my career. I got the chance to start a data team, and the data team, you know, obviously grew to a large size as the company blew up and ultimately got acquired by Microsoft. So I got the opportunity to...
What employee were you at Yammer, roughly?
I say that I was like employee number 100 at every single company that I've ever joined until, of course, Mozart, where I was a co-founder. But I think the actual answer is 102, and I think I was the 90th person in the room, which basically meant that a number of people had left. But I was, I say number 100. And I take a lot of pride in that. I think a lot of people have these sort of career defining parts of their journey. And for me, that was a really special run at Yammer, an incredible team, many of whom have gone on to really great things. A lot of great coworkers, some of whom work with me today at Mozart Data.
Awesome. So you get sort of indoctrinated by the PayPal mafia, and then Yammer goes off to sell to Microsoft. Take me through, you did a stint at Zenefits as well, and a few other startups along the way. What were you sort of like, were you intentional about trying to learn specific things with each new move you took on your journey to becoming a startup founder? And the reason why I ask that is like the Silicon Valley kind of quote unquote standard where you go bigger, smaller, 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 smaller until you eventually just start your own company. Like, did you intentionally try to do that? Or was it always just like, this seems like a really good opportunity, I will learn as much as possible?
I sort of agree with the idea. I call it like working your way down the ladder.
Yeah.
So like being able to be valuable at a 1,000-person company, then being able to be valuable at a 100-person company, then being able to be valuable at a 10-person company, and then being able to, you know, start your own type of company. There was no intention there. So, you know, I think a lot of what was happening over the last decade, especially in the data space, was that there was a massive supply-demand imbalance.
Yeah.
So data was becoming cheap, available, consumable, very standard, that companies would compete leveraging it. And there weren't a lot of folks with a lot of chops in sort of tech, data, that sort of overlap, statistics. So I found myself as having a lot of really cool and exciting opportunities. Many of them were swings and hits, and many were swings and misses, and many were, oh man, I wish I could have done.
Mm.
But, you know, I think that there's been a lot of like opportunity to work with really great, exciting teams. And typically these teams are hiring data people as they're trying to optimize something. So the company is on a really exciting part of the roller coaster ride. You know, when I was at Zenefits, which ended up being not the most exciting end part of the adventure, but it was certainly when we joined, you know, it went from about 300 people to almost 3,000 people in about a year while I was there, and then essentially back down to the original size. And that's, you know, the first part of that roller coaster is incredibly exciting. And, you know, I also work with some Zenefits people now today at Mozart Data, one incredibly like talented organization, and then they've of course gone on to have spawned many very subsequently successful companies.
Right.
So, you know, I was always trying to optimize for sort of getting to work with great people, competitive, like great network, people that I really thought, you know, produce great work and I could learn from them adjacently. But I was always trying to grow my skill set to fields very close and touching data.
Mm.
So when I was at Zenefits, I started running the growth team, which was a field that, of course, like when you're running data, it makes sense. You know, if you're trying to optimize your ads, that's all really data and math and stats problems. Now, like places like Facebook and Google solve this for you. But back in the day, it was really important to be very close with the data team. And what I was trying to do were, there's a lot of disciplines where they put a data person with that discipline. And
right.
I was like, no, maybe
like embed the
exactly.
data person on everything.
And I was,
yeah.
you know, that was my job at
yeah.
Playdom, and then actually subsequently the folks that I managed at Yammer. I always thought that the opposite made more sense to me, which is take very savvy folks that can look at the data the right way, and then attach to them somebody that can build the creative that they need, that can experiment with the creative that they need.
Mm.
And so I was trying to flip the script of a couple of roles. And that's really kind of how I felt like I was expanding my skill set and then going on to you know, ultimately start my own startup.
You had some pretty bright lines in how you felt data teams and data should be consumed within organizations. And so like at a certain point you got frustrated and you're like, I need to do this myself.
I think there's a lot of data people that like really relish the role of being the consigliere,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, really taking, having the space to go and make an informed, like by the books, this is the right call. You know,
right.
And I actually started my career before I was in tech. I say this all the time, I was in the NFL.
Mm.
Not as a player, but I was the statistician for the Philadelphia Eagles.
Right.
And, you know, there's sort of like a great spot where you can, you know, hand Andy Reid, who was the coach at the time, this is the 2-point chart. And, you know, when you're down by this many points with this much time, this is what you should do.
Yeah.
And it's, and, you know, I think people love that role, but then they start to really want the role of no, like I want to have that decision power. I want to have agency in that decision, not just advising on what should be done theoretically. So, so I think that was like part of the journey. And then the other part, like you said, was we're very opinionated about what analytics should look like.
Mm.
And it looked similar and different at many companies. You know, obviously, a lot of the problems look the same, but we had a very opinionated take about what a data team should do, how they should contribute to the company, and the types of tools that were needed. And, you know, 10 years ago, you couldn't buy those tools in the same way that you can today. So sort of building internally, the types of tools that I that are now quite prevalent, you know, but having a huge, massive budget from Microsoft and Disney to do that was a nice luxury. And now we're just simply building these tools for everyone.
Awesome. I want to get into like day one. So you're like, I'm starting Mozart. I've resigned from, where were you at the time?
I had left Ease.
You were at Ease, yeah.
And, yeah. And this was actually right before the pandemic.
Yeah.
And,
which by the way, a product that I'm sure, I think you explained to me, did extraordinarily well during the pandemic. Delivery canvas.
There's literally no, like the reverse of a black swan event than like COVID for this, you know, for companies like Zoom or like Ease, like it's
yeah.
just, you know, it creates product market fit.
Yeah. So you were there, you had left at this point. I guess talk to me about the first couple months. Like what was like getting everything together? Like, did you do a pass the hat around type of round? Like, did you self-fund?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I had an opportunity to work with my good friend Dan.
Yeah.
Dan and I have been friends for 20 years. We met in college, and he and I started sort of throwing ideas around about what we might like to work on. And he and I had founded like a hot sauce company together 12 years ago. So we didn't want to work on hot sauce again.
What's the name of it again?
It's bacon hot sauce. So Dan and I invented bacon flavored hot sauce.
Awesome.
But we're both data nerds in the Valley, and you know we're sort of throwing around like crazy ideas that might be fun to work on. And then of course, it made sense. We kind of zeroed in on what our actual skill set was.
Mm.
I think a lot of times, you know, people can have very entrepreneurial ambitions, but like starting on first base really helps. Which is we both were extremely opinionated about what good looks like in the data space.
Mm.
And you
had credibility, right? Like having worked in many of these.
We had a little bit of that. it helps. I mean, I think it's like, all of the ideas were bad ideas, and they all sort of gravitated towards kind of working something in the field that we really had a deep understanding of.
What would you say, you guys get together, it's clear you want to work on this together. I think, had you applied to YC at this point or yeah?
We had and hadn't. Like the company came together the night of the YC like application. In fact, the YC application is we applied as Mario Data, which is of course not our name. We are Mozart Data, but, we had an idea of doing something with like data pipelines, which ultimately became data orchestration. But Dan had done YC about a decade ago, and there is sort of this magic to working crazy hard for 3 months that he really felt like was necessary for our two personalities. So,
by the way, I would say that's important. 10 year previously, what the batch sizes were minuscule. And he decided to come back to the well. So, yeah, it works for even people having gone through multiple times
before. Yeah, so Dan had done winter 10, and we did, you know, we graduated summer 20.
Yeah.
And we did apply to YC.
Do you remember your interview at all?
Well, I remember our interviews plural. So, so we pitched basically our pipelines idea, and I think the partners really felt like it was an immature idea, and it was an immature idea. You know, I think, you know, we obviously didn't have customers and we didn't have a lot of the sort of standard validation. So they asked us to come back, in a month with some progress, and we did, we worked really hard. I mean, we worked incredibly hard for a month, and I knew whether we got into YC or we didn't, we had actually pushed ourselves really far. That so YC was more like 4 months for us because we you know initially
so you basically
got asked
reapply.
Yeah. We got asked to re-interview and then we actually got into our class. I think maybe it was only a few days before the class started, but we were sort of gung-ho and ready to hit the ground running.
Everything was up and to the right after that. Right?
Well, I should say, like, the second interview wasn't cake either. You know, we had Michael Seibel, who,
oh my gosh.
Like, you know, of course, gives us the business. But, like, on top of it, The most daunting part of the Michael Seibel interview is you never know when you're actually going to have that interview, because Michael Seibel, you know, takes every 20-minute interview and it ends up being like longer. So we're just waiting and waiting and getting more and more nervous. Maybe this is not going to happen, but it all, you know, obviously it all worked out. We hit the ground running.
Whether or not you make it into YC, it's important to realize that like that sprint is really crucial for a company getting off the ground and just applying like a ton of focus. So what were the things that you really hoped to achieve during the batch and leading up to demo day, if you recall?
So, I mean, there was the goal of fundraising. I mean, you know, now, I mean, YC just announced that they're now doing, you know, $500,000 investment in these companies. So, you know, for us, it was, you know, we did, you know, after YC, you know, Dan and I self-funded the company until we had gotten the YC capital, and then we had actually hired someone from Yammer at that point, and so you know, it was an expense to get started, but the three of us, you know, sort of got the company going and off the ground. The big goal was, of course, fundraising, but like that's more like the outcome. It's like Bill Walsh has the famous book, The
Score
Takes Care of
Itself,
which is basically like fundraising definitely takes care of itself if you have like any, you know, honestly, we were raising at what was the best time. So coming out of the pandemic, money was really crazy tight the first month after, and then afterwards got looser and looser and looser.
Yep.
And just like, I think you just had to demonstrate something great, whether it's product traction, a deep understanding of the market, a vision for what you wanted to build. So for us in YC, it was really all about customers.
Yeah.
And going from zero to one, we actually went from zero to three customers.
Hmm.
Although all three like signed, like, I think it was like the week before demo day.
Oh.
So
that's getting your teeth. Yeah.
Got great deals, I think. As a result, but like,
are they up for renewal?
they're great customers to this day. But I mean, like, there really is like an infinity between zero and one.
Yeah.
So, you know, we had all these beta customers that were using us. We were free trialing. We were giving away Snowflake credits to like try our product. And there was a really exciting moment where we used the standard YC SaaS form and said, here's your order form and here's what it's going to cost you. And then here are the overages. And would you like to sign? And it's a really nerve-wracking moment.
You like cross your fingers.
You know, you're playing it cool, but yeah, whatever. And it was a really, you know, obviously it's like, you know, when we had the hot sauce company, when we sold our first bottle, you know, that was exciting. But when we sold our first bottle to somebody that didn't have either Dan or my last name, that was crazy exciting. And, you know, you're not doing the frame dollar, but like these SaaS contracts are really meaningful. It's somebody, you know, honestly, two of our first three customers were, you know, friends or adjacent friends. You know, it's part you sell into your network. And it's one thing to get, you know, your friend to try out your product. It's another thing to for them to, you know, give you five figures as a contract. It's another thing to ask for a six-figure contract. So it's like, those are no longer friends. Those are customers.
Well, Michael talks about this a lot, which is basically like surveys for startups are worthless because... But getting somebody to pay for your product is that's real value, obviously real value, and in sort of testing the thesis of the startup, right? And so to that point, they might say as a friend, like, yeah, I'd use that.
Yeah.
But when they start giving you, you know, $10,000 a month, that's like, okay.
Yeah, that's
they become a better friend.
Yeah. Well, yes, great friend, but more accurately, great customer.
Yeah.
And then you really have to do right by the customer. I mean, not just because they're your friend, but because, I mean, that is a real customer with real consequences if they were to churn.
I want to provide a little bit of context for non-technical data people on the difference between data pipe versus data orchestration. Like, what was that shift in for non-technical folks?
So there is no difference. These are just sort of buzzwords that data people throw around. That said, the small kind of focusing of our company was really, really important in going from a bad idea to a better idea.
Yep.
So originally we wanted to work on tools that basically sped up data teams, that Dan and I had worked on teams that had built transform tools within those teams. So they took, you know, data engineers and mm-hmm. backend engineers mm-hmm. and built tools that should be built once centrally by somebody.
And not bespoke for every single
exactly
use case.
You know, this is not the way to compete on data. It's to build your own version of this. So we wanted to build sort of a standalone tool that mirrored some of the things that we had built previously. I had a friend that was going to try our product
mm-hmm.
only because I was involved and
mm-hmm.
it was a friend of mine. And the person was very excited about it and says, oh, yeah, I heard this is important. Maybe I should be using something like it. And it was great. And then said, actually, I not only that, I want to be a customer. I'm like, oh, great.
Wow.
And like, how much do you think we could, you know, how much could we charge you for this? He goes, well, like, what's the market? I said, like, this is what this company charges. This is what this company charges. He goes, well, how about $100 a month? And, you know, it's like actually like a pretty fair price for our offering at the time. I mean, this was
very beginning.
Very, very beginning. And I thought to myself, oh, my God, like the quantity of companies that I have to sell. It was that realization of the moment that when you actually ask somebody to pay for something,
you get the real reality answer.
And if this was the tool that we were going to build, and so this is not like Apple where you're like, I could pay you $100 a month and that's fine.
Right.
And I'm going to sell to a billion people. We'd sell to hundreds or even a thousand companies.
Right.
And we're going to make that much money. Like, that's
so
just not going to work.
Yeah.
So that was kind of our moment of
realization. Yeah, your plans were not a lifestyle business, four-hour work week, Tim Ferriss style.
That's right.
Yeah.
And for us to build the best in class, we weren't going to be able to get away with that.
I also think that, like, it's a moment in time now where data is so embedded in organizations and the way that people make decisions. I mean, you said, even in your background, everybody down to the NFL, I mean, we all know the Billy Beane story with Oakland A's, like that's now commonplace across all sports. You land your three customers, 0 to 3, like in the nick of time, right before demo day.
That's right.
Talk to me a little bit about how you were thinking about fundraising, because you had raised essentially a small bit of capital.
Yeah.
And like, you're like, okay, we've got to do a seed round now. Talk to me about how you thought through that. Was it deck first? Was it, I mean, there's a whole process in YC that you don't have to get into here, but like deck first, list first, kind of.
Yeah, so I have a strong thesis about how to raise a seed round.
Mm-hmm.
This is very kind of, it reminds me so much of our own sort of surprisingly struggle. Like not that I expected everybody to line up for the opportunity to invest in Mozart data, but I was expecting there to be like a strong amount of demand. And there was. But, you know, I got, I think, close to about 200 rejections.
Mm.
You know, now Michael NYC will say, don't waste your time talking to people that are uninterested in you. It's like, well, you know, like, I don't know who's uninterested in me. So I ended up, you know, having a huge, investor CRM, going through, talking to people, pitching, demoing our product, explaining what I sort of saw as the vision for the product. And, you know, I got, you know, I think I pitched about 200 people and I got about, you know, 190 rejections or whatever it is. So we did a little bit of a party round, but my thesis is typically you want to be, you basically want to be oversubscribed always. So we kind of had this vision of raising $3 million.
Right.
And, you know, we had $125,000 from YC.
Yep.
We had between Dan's family and my own, another 25,000. So we had 150,000. We had 150 from YC, and we had about another 50 from our family. So we ended up with about 200K, and we had 2.8 to go.
Yeah.
So one way of doing it is going out, having a seed deck, and saying, I'm looking to raise $2.8 million to go change the world of data.
Yeah.
And here's the data market. It's hundreds of billions of dollars a year.
If we get 1% of that,
we're going to be the coolest, bestest, IPOist company. And I think that's super wrong. Instead, we raised 300,000, so we got to 500,000 from basically friends and family.
Mm.
I said,
here's the first tranche.
Here's a tranche.
Yeah.
We're going to get this. And I know I can raise 300 grand from my friends and family.
Right.
And a lot of them wanted to do it.
Yeah.
Not like, you know, some small checks, you know, $5,000 checks, some people that wanted to put in $100,000. We didn't even let them.
Take grandma's
so,
money.
We sort of made, we got in the family investment, and then we started to get the friends on board. So we had, you know, $500,000, but we knew there was like more of that where that came from.
Right.
You know, then we're sort of negotiating from a position of power, which is like, you know, Dan and I could bootstrap the company on 50K. We sure could bootstrap it on 500K.
Yeah.
You know, we had this bigger ambition. And again, so now we had 500,000 and then we ended up raising another 1.5 million.
Mm.
And then we raised another, you know, 2 million. But at each time,
yep,
the round was like, you know, more people wanted in on the round than what was available.
Got it.
So
always be oversubscribed.
I think it's really like there is something to
psychological.
It, you know, and some, you know, some founders can bluff it. So like you have to figure out who you are. So like Dan and I knew our strengths. We were two technical founders, two nerds that like had a great network in the data space, had opinions about the data space. Some founders are like good enough that they can basically do the bluff. Oh, please, we're oversubscribed. We get this, that. It's like.
Yeah.
We were actually oversubscribed, so we actually didn't have to do a lot of bluffing. It was kind of, it's not like a take it or leave it, but you know, Michael has this thing where if somebody's really, really, really interested in you, they're not interested. If they're, you know, crazy interested in you, they're a maybe. You know, and it's like, and then like,
I need to go back and look at my notes. There are no.
Exactly.
I want to normalize 200 because that's really important for founders to hear. Oftentimes I'll get founders, and I say this in every episode, I'll oftentimes get founders to be like, I'm so burnt out. I've talked to so many people and they said no. And I'm like, how many people have you talked to? And they're like 20. And I'm like, you need to 10X that, especially for pre-seed or seed. And it just, it is what it is. Like you have a very credible background. You've come from great institutions within Silicon Valley. And you're a data guy building a data company with pilots from real customers. Still hard.
And the one thing that you're missing, in one of the best funding environments for seed companies ever.
Yeah.
All of those things were true, with and actually having assembled already a small and awesome team.
And having built Bacon Hot Sauce.
And having the mildly mildly successful hot sauce endeavor.
That's a good, you know, like if you get allocation in Mozart, you get a little
slice of Bacon Hot Sauce. That's certainly... something that could be worked out.
So what was the final result? What was the raise?
So we raised $4 million.
Okay. Did you
have
like a lead or any?
I mean, again, I sort of cheated. So Kraft was our lead.
Okay.
So I had worked with David and Brian at both Yammer and Zenefits.
Right.
And you know, Brian is now on our board. And and it's really great to sort of have, you know, it's one of those things, again, where... there were a lot of people that were very interested in us, and these folks, you know, knew our work, and a lot of the money that we ended up raising came from folks that knew our work, knew our product, or had sort of had some experience with either a founder or one of the early team members. So we sort of,
there's embedded trust there.
Yeah, exactly. And then, it got us to a great place pretty quickly.
Okay. Congrats on the amazing round.
Thank you.
I always like to end on 12-month plan, 10-year plan.
Sure. I mean, the 12-month plan is pretty mundane. It's grow our customer base, and it's to grow our and our team. So we have right now we have actually a pretty large team. We're over 20 people, and the goal is to get to over 30.
Mm-hmm.
And so our 12-month plan is to do some hiring and some key functions, a lot of engineering, a lot of go-to-market. What I think is a little bit different about our get customers plan is multifold. It's sort of expanding our offering so that, you know, it's an all-in-one data pipeline. And we also have what I call a BYOS offering, which means bring your own snowflake. So we basically have all the components of the data pipeline. You can get the all-in-one package, or you can sort of do the piecemeal. So it's like going to McDonald's. Do you want the, you know, the
$2
meal,
yeah,
or do you want
the $2
the
items?
Hamburgers. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. 10-year vision.
I see, I see a world in which unicorns, decacorns do not need data engineers.
Mm.
Like, I want the first data engineering hire to be employee number 1,000. Mm. So I mentioned that I joined multiple companies as employee number 100, mm. which is typically where you see a lot of
data
companies
teams.
Starting to build data teams, maybe hiring data engineers even earlier. That's not really what I think should be the state of the world. Your initial data hires should be people that are really savvy at cutting the data, at working with BizOps and RevOps and the product teams and, you know.
Higher order analysis.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Doing the competitive stuff, which is understanding the business and understanding how the data translates to the outcome that you want. Not figuring out, okay, how do I get my data from Stripe into this data warehouse?
Totally,
it's like,
yeah.
So today, you know, I think a lot of the automated EL tools, you know, Fivetran, Stitch, etc., like have solved part of that problem, which is moving mm-hmm. the data from very standard tools into a central data warehouse. But I think that there's still like a daunting piece to using Fivetran or a columnar or whatever the thing is. And what we want to do is make it so that if you're a company, your default 1,000th hire
mm.
is your data engineer.
Mm.
And before that, you wouldn't think of it. You would think of buy first.
Got it. Thanks for coming on the show.
Awesome.
If people want to join a really awesome early team, go to mozartdata.com.
That's
great. And there's a careers link there.
That's great.
And other than that, it's been awesome to have you. And I think the future is bright.
Thanks. Thanks so much.